happened to Professor Clauser. He didn't even get his tenure because he was studying this, and people accused him that he doesn't believe quantum mechanics or something like that. Basically, in that time, this subject is not the mainstream of physics community, and it's not welcome, I guess, in that time. So he's really my hero. Second, I consider Ebner my teacher. Hopefully, I'm not the, I consider myself your student. Hopefully, not a bad student. But anyway, in the beginning of my, my thesis, and I had a wonderful thesis committee that I passed my oral exam, and Wheeler was there, and Wigner was there, and also my thesis advisor, Kara Ali. And this suggests me a set of papers to read, of course, including historical paper of EPR, Bell, and beautiful, beautiful experiment by Aspe and by Clauser, Fry, and a very thick review paper, by famous review paper by Clauser and Shimani. And I asked them, you gave me so many papers, which one I supposed to read? I was surprised. They didn't suggest me to read a original EPR. They didn't even suggest me to read the beautiful experiment by Allen, but suggest me to read Ebner's review paper. Okay, to study this paper, you can have a broad understanding of what's happening in this field, which is the subject. And I can tell you that now I became a teacher. I teach my student, and the first paper I gave them is still this paper. So in my group, sometimes I heard that they said, well, where is my Bible? You're looking for around. What they mean is this paper. That famous now is the Bible of my future student. Well, I'm going to talk about the physics of 2 is not 1 plus 1. Hopefully, after this talk, that Ebner would not consider I'm a bad student. Okay, let's see. Okay, this is from my group. A lot of people contribute to this work. And basically, I'm the person who's in charge with the experiment, and the Professor Rubin is in charge with the theory. Here are our graduate students. Here are the, some of them, the postdoctors, some of them are visiting scholars in this short time visit. Of course, we start to, from this paper. This is the paper everybody knows. It starts from the subject. In 1935, and EPR published this paper. And the, first of all, they proposed an entangled two-particle state. So according to the principle of quantum mechanics from the superposition, and they proposed this state. If you look at the state, and we can use two data functions to summarize this EPR state. They point out a very surprised phenomenon. The momentum or position for neither subsystem in this state is determined. However, if one particle is measured to have a certain momentum or position, the momentum or position of its twin is determined with certainty, and despite the distance between those two. That's a pretty interesting phenomenon. That's the EPR delta function. So although you have for subsystem one, for example, you measure the position of that, you have a infinity uncertainty for one for two in momentum, both infinity. But if you measure the distance between the two, you have a zero uncertainty. That's a delta function about x1 minus x2. And you get a zero uncertainty on the measurement of p1 plus p2. Okay. That's pretty surprised. So if we, let's try to use, I like this cartoon, that idea about shooting a cat. So always trying to use that to to see something, okay? It may not be correct, but anyway, let's try to see if it's interesting. So this is like that. We have a pair of interaction-free. First of all, those cats, they don't communicate. It's very important, okay? To propagate to distant locations. So we are asking such kind of a cat that each of the cats are in the state of a life and a death simultaneously. At the same time, we ask the two has to be observed both alive or both dead, and despite the distance between those two. So those two are pretty, okay. Probably that there will be probably no problem. No surprise, if our observation is based on a large number of alive, or dead twin cats. That's the model a lot of people trying to do, to simulate, still doing that. But here, we're talking about a pair and a cat. We said a pair has to be observed both alive or both dead, whenever we look at that. And the a pair, or each pair of the, each cat of the pair is alive and dead simultaneously. Why do I see that? Are we sure we're talking about a pair to be alive and dead simultaneously? That means it's pure state, but not for an ensemble of pairs in which 50% alive, 50% are dead. It's a mixed state. Yes, we're sure, because we know the EPR state is a pure state. Only the pure state and give us this delta function. This is just simple Fourier transform. Okay, you get back and forth to delta function. Only this pure state can do that. So the EPR state is a pure state. It is characterized by two delta functions simultaneously. A statistical mixed state may hold one of them. You can have this or that, but never both. That's a pretty important thing. It's really that the EPR state is the result of a quantum mechanical superposition. So this is the, we have the eigenstate of momentum with a special, very special, that the distribution function, the delta function on the momentum, and of course you do a Fourier transform, you get that the delta function for the position. The same thing happened to the momentum. But if you look at this superposition, it's a little bit different than our normal understanding. This is not a superposition of with a one particle, but with a pair of particles. So this is what we call the two particle superposition. If we look at the statistical mixed state, they really work differently. Suppose I have a density matrix, and yes, we do have this kind of correlation pair by pair, and sometimes like they have a different value of p1, p2, but always hold the delta function. They have a opposite direction by equal value, something like that. But you never get delta function for position. Or you can model your mixed state with delta function distribution in position, but you can never get in momentum. So the EPR state is very special. You do have two delta functions simultaneously. That's an interesting difference. So let's try to compare to see that. So this is a really difference between a pure state and a static mixed state. The pure state, like see, we're still using a cat. This is a cat. So we said we have 100 cats, all and each of them are simultaneously alive and dead. So this 100 cat, they are pure, with the set we describe this assemble of cat with pure state. So each of them has to be in the same superposition. And the statistical mixture that, yes, we have 100 cat, the 50 of them is we have alive, 50 of them are dead. That's okay. but it's very, very different. So let's look at, this is a single cat. If we have two cats, there's two particle pure state, and against that, the statistics mixture is, we have 100 cats, if you look, all and each of the pair, now we're talking about pair, are in the same superposition state of alive, 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 and dead, dead. It's against this statistics mixture that if we have 100 cat pairs, now we're talking about pairs, and 50 pairs are alive, alive, another 50 are dead, dead. We are talking about pairs. So that's a very, very different. The difference gives us different result. Basically, is this important delta function, the EPR delta function. We have two delta functions simultaneously in that conjugate space, momentum, and the position. Of course, when you have a delta function where uncertainty equal to zero, it must be a perfect EPR state. Even though it's, suppose this is not perfect, but you can still, we call it EPR inequality. You can still satisfy if it's a EPR type state, okay, or entangled state, you can satisfy this inequality. So subsystem one, you have uncertainty delta x1, and the subsystem two, you have delta x2. A minimum, one of them is probably minimum. It's a narrower, you have a smaller uncertainty. The correlation can be smaller than that and satisfy both simultaneously. A statistical mixed state may satisfy one of them, but never both. You cannot do that. That's the important physics. And this comes quite a surprise, at least to Einstein. Now here, first of all, certainly it is interaction free. Those two particles going away to the left, to the right, far away, there's no interaction. And of course, Einstein believed that there's no communication when you have space-like separate measurement events. Okay, that means two measurements, you cannot get any communication. So there's no interaction between two distant quantum or quanta, and then no action at the distance between individual measurements to EPR. The two quanta and are independent as well as the measurement. So that this is a typical statistics. So you have two independent measurements, two independent in this case, and subsystems. And if you measure, this is statistics. And the error you measure for x1 minus 2 has to be added like that, of course, has to be bigger than the maximum of each of the maximum of those two, one of those the two, okay? So in both position and in both momentum. So this is a classical inequality. So if you get the less than minimum like that, of course, it's quite a surprise. The apparent contradiction deeply troubled Einstein. So when, well, one sees the measurement on P1 plus P2 and X1 minus X2 of two individual particles satisfy the EPR delta function, and it believes the classical inequality, one might easily be trapped into considering either there is a violation of the uncertain principle or there exists action at a distance. So that could be. But actually, let's look at the problem from the beginning, from the EPR state. I would say that probably that the Feynman statement probably correct. Okay, what he said, once he said, the only mystery of quantum mechanics is the superposition principle. Now, of course, here, let's look at this superposition. This is a superposition between two particle states. So this one amplitude, another, they have a special, very special distribution here. And you add them together, you get Fourier transform, you get the delta function in space, and vice versa here in the momentum space. So this is really, we are talking something, it's about the two photon or two particle superposition. That superposition responsible for those two delta functions, those two delta functions is really made trouble to understand and to a lot of us. So photon probably is one of the good concepts for the physics of superposition. It's a good example about the state and about the measurement. And also, in my lab, we have a limit. We only deal with photons. Hopefully, one day, I can start atomic physics like Alan is doing. Anyway, so a photon. Let's try to see that how did we develop the concept? In the beginning, we are talking about h bar omega. That really corresponding to a transition, for example, you have a transition that E1 and E2, they have to be just a constant level. You cannot have a delta E2, for example. If you do have a delta E2 associated with the level E2, it happens in reality, then the transition you have, you really don't know which H bar omega is coming from the photon. You get a superposition. It's a really superposition of all the excited mode. So that's the state for this transition. Describe the photon, or the field. Okay, if it's, but in the single photons level, we always see the state of the field, of the photon, of the single photon. So the result of this superposition is going to give us a wave packet. Of course, we don't have a wave packet, wave function concept for photon. We know that, okay? But we have to do it differently, and usually we call the operational approach. That will turn to a global theory. Global provide us a tool for us to calculate this wave packet. It's, I think Alan did some reveal, so I would go quickly. Now here is the, first of all, we're talking about G1. We have one detector for a measurement of a photon. Let's see that. The experiment is very simple. So here is the state of that photon. And here is the operator, the field operator. Okay, the field operator at the position of the detector. Okay, so first we have to use Green's function to develop that operator from the source to the detector, and then we put them together. If a single photon state, it's very easy to show that that's equivalent to that average to the state is equivalent to this normal square. So we can define the zero E plus psi as a, we call the wave function or effective wave function of the photon. We define that. Then rest of that is very easy to calculate. We put the operator here, we put the state there, and finally we get a integral. It's really a Fourier transform that from this distribution in the omega space, and we get a wave packet. Very simple. This wave packet is the result of a coherent superposition. Quantum mechanically, the measurement cannot precisely locate a light quantum within the uncertainty of the wave packet. So that's what we get. We do the same thing for a pair of photons, like EPR. Okay, we can call the biphoton. Why don't we call, you can see that later. Now, corresponding A transition, now this is cascade transition. Okay, so cascade, we have photon 1, photon 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And the 1 and the 2, they can have all different combinations. You know, we simplify this model. Actually, we should consider another integral of the delta E2, but here we try to simplify it. Otherwise, we get too complicated. We have more dimensions. Now here we make just E1, E2, and this transition. Of course, that we don't know which omega 1 or omega 2 they are. They can be different, very differently, so we have to make a sum But we do know the sum of omega 1, omega 2 is E2 minus E1 divided by H bar. It's a constant. We know that, okay? So we have this superposition. And that superposition result in of two, it's a two photon superposition, give us a 2D wave packet. So let's see how do we calculate that. It's pretty straightforward calculation. We're still using global theory. Now, this is a G2, the second order correlation function. Now you have two detectors. There's a pair of photon and they trigger your two detectors. We are calculating the probability of a produce a joint detection event at x1, t1, x2, t2. So this is the event for the first triggering of the detector 1. That's the event for the triggering of the detector 2. So this is the probability for that to produce a joint detection event. We calculate that. And also, you can define here with 0, this is E plus 2, E plus 1, which they say as a effective two photon wave function, or two photon wave in short. Very easy to calculate. And finally, you get two-dimensional wave Fourier transform. If you look at this wave packet, it's non-factorizable if we have a EPR state, okay, or delta function, or non-factorizable, or anyway, non-factorizable with omega 1, omega 2, then you get a non-factorizable two-dimensional wave packet. We call this biphoton. Actually, the name was given first by Professor Kushko. I think I like that name. So a biphoton is the result of superposition of two photon state. Surely you have a superposition of that. Quantum mechanically, the measurement on T1 minus T2 can achieve resolution even beyond the classical limit of delta T1 minus T2. Okay, so this is classical. That can be smaller. We have seen that from EPR from the beginning. The one thing we have to warn, I think probably you see that already. The two photon superposition is really non-local. Let's look at the classical, the single particle global theory. We calculate with one detector, a triggering of one photon, we get a probability for that photon triggering event to be happen. And that superposition, this is superposition, we do have a classical model, classical correspondence. You can see it's the E field, okay? The E field superposed at the detector. So you get the normal square dot corresponding to intensity. But if you look at this superposition, we have two detectors. The E field going two different positions. The field doesn't meet together. You have to add them together by detection. Through the detection, the field doesn't add. The field, you cannot add this field, this field one, field two, field one, field two, field. You cannot do that. You have to add them together through the measurement by the two distant detectors. Yeah, that is really something that bothers me. And probably bother all of us. So the superposition happens between different yet equivalent two photon amplitudes that lead to a joint detection event of two photon detectors at distant space-time points, okay, like that. This represents a quite troubling concept in classical physics because there is no counterpart of such concept in classical electrodynamics theory. So the uncertainties for entangled EPR photon pairs, so we do have simultaneously, this we're talking about photon now, okay? We have delta T1 minus T2 is equal to 0, and delta omega 1 plus omega 2 equals 0 simultaneously. Although, and each of the subsystems, they have a big uncertainty, okay? Probably infinity in certain cases. So I would emphasize that really, we, from the weak function or from the weak packet point of view, we have a non-factorizable two-dimensional weak packet or weak function is not equal to one another, like two weak packets. So that's really two is now one plus one. That's the meaning of that. And sometimes I give a talk about the subject, and immediately people ask a question is this. When you have simultaneously those two delta functions equal to simultaneously, is that a violation of the uncertain principle? And people see that directly, so well, that's a violation. Actually, it's not, because those two operators, not in the photon case, we're going back to the particle now, okay? Those all two operators are not conjugate variables. Why it's not? Okay, you can see that from this very simple Fourier transform. And this is two-dimensional Fourier transform. And here's the plus one, minus one. Okay, then we say plus, plus, minus, minus. Okay, those two are correspondents and not those two. Okay, let's look at that. This is easy. So those two are conjugate variables. Those two are conjugate variables. Now, if we look at diagonal like this, it doesn't matter. Okay. And yes, when you have this equal to zero, that one must be infinity. And this equal to zero, that one must be infinity. Okay. It has been observed in experiment. So now the observation, okay, then people ask, well, this is not a violation of the uncertain principle. Why the 1935 paper of EPR, they tried to drive us to the conclusion to a violation of the uncertain principle. Okay, what they did is like in following this, really. So first of all, you said from this state, we should have this kind of observation. Now, if you really believe they are independent particles, they are independent measurements, and you should believe classical inequality, right? You have to believe that, otherwise you get trouble. How do you get that? Each of them, they have a huge uncertainty. It's not a pair by pair. And how do you get that kind of delta function? If you have to believe that. If you believe that, of course, you conclude both of them has to be zero, otherwise you can never get zero, right? If you have all zeros, then of course this violation of us. That's their driven, try to driven us following that kind of philosophy. Okay. Well, the EPR delta function, although it is not the violation of the uncertain principle, but it's truly a violation of the classical inequalities. So we should know that. Then people may ask a question. So you said everything about two. How much we know about one? How much we know about a subsystem in the EPR system? So let's see. The EPR two-particle system is a pure state. We know everything about the two. Actually, we know everything about the relationship between the two. Okay. That's a pure state. And for the subsystem, what do you do? Of course, it's very easy for us. We have the tool. We learn from quantum mechanics. You trace away the second particle, right? You trace it away, and you get density matrix of the first one. This is really a mixed state. Okay, it's a mixed state. Now, when you compare those two, a lot of people get trouble. I think many years, me too. Okay, I always mix up those two concepts, two about one, mix them together, immediately you get trouble. One of the famous arguments is the negative entropy. We know that von Neumann entropy, he defined like that, and also people use that as an information theory, okay, for information theory. For the pure EPR state, the entropy is zero. For the subsystem, for both one and two, it's greater than zero, the entropy. You have two subsystems, entropy greater than zero. You add them together, you go to zero. What's happening there? Okay, there must be something. And people do have a model. They have an interpretation. Well, it looks okay because what they say, okay, the entropy for the for subsystem one is the plus the conditional entropy of the subsystem one equal to zero. Okay, they get a solution at least mathematically. So then immediately when you look at this formula, we have a problem. What is the problem? If you read very carefully, this is a quotation from one of this paper. I would not mention who, but anyway, from the paper, said that given the result of a measurement over one particle, the result of the measurement over the other must yield negative information. So what's that mean? I don't know who's in the information theory who understand that. But I really don't understand. That's the reason I put it here. Maybe later I'll ask Abner. Tell me. Okay. So anyway, this is a brief review about this two is not one plus one. Okay, this concept. First, then we ask, does nature allow the entangled state? Of course, there's a lot of those, like cascade decay, that Clauser, Fry, and Aspect did in the early days. And actually, we start from the parametric down conversion. It's a spontaneous parametric down conversion for the EPR study. It's really studied from Maryland. Okay. As I think many people know that. What is the spontaneous parametric down conversion? We use a nonlinear crystal. It's the nonlinear means there's a significant chi 2. It's the second order susceptibility. We have a laser beam sent into the crystal, and simultaneously a pair of photons generated. And usually, historically, we call one signal another Adler. Actually, they're equivalent. The reason called signal Adler because historically, in many years ago, usually the Adler is in infrared. Nobody look at that. They only look at the visible in signal. So that state is very easy to calculate by first order perturbation. Okay, very easily you get this state, and you generate a signal, an Adler mode, and the distribution functions, you have two delta functions. One is energy conservation, another momentum conservation. So basically, if you do a Fourier transform, you can have time correlation and spatial correlation. Okay, those delta functions turn to another delta function to space-time. This is the real source when you look at that. Actually, of course, when we take this picture, we have to take a lot of pairs. But in principle, one pair is supposed to give us this distribution because that's the pure state. The one pair, you're supposed to have all the probability amplitude to be any color and to be any propagation direction. So first of all, we want to see that when we have this pair, this kind of source, we do have space-time delta functions. Okay? We want to show that, you know, that we know that when we have this state, we must have they call the phase matching technically. If you don't have phase matching, you cannot generate this kind of state. The phase matching means those two delta functions in energy and the momentum. Now we want to show another delta function in space-time. So this is the purpose. We did an experiment called the ghost imaging in 1995. This is an experiment demonstration of the EPR delta function in transverse momentum and transverse position. So look at this experiment. This experiment, let me tell you about a little bit about the experiment. Now, first of all, we have a source. This source is a nonlinear crystal pumped by a laser beam, and a pair of photons, two photons generated as a pair, signal and Adler. And when we generate that, we did it on purpose. Those two photons are perpendicular, polarized. So they're called a type two phase matching. We get one photon polarized horizontally, another polarized vertically. So then we use a polarizing beam splitter to separate signal and idler. We send the signal photon to a detector. That is a point detector, very tiny. It's a photodiode. On the way of this signal, we pass a lens here. And behind that is a aperture. And what is there? Aperture is it's a UMBC. It's my student made that. Okay, they put a UMBC behind that. And then a lens focuses all the light down to a spot, to a tiny point detector. So of course, we're not going to learn any spatial information about the UMBC for that detector, right? Nothing. It just says that detector played the role, just the photon counting. Give you 1, 2, 3, 4, just count. So whenever you get a click, open the gate for detector two. So that means really we're doing a joint detection. Okay, this is a joint detection. So if our detector D1, D2 catch the twin every time, okay, now we start to, that detector is fixed in space. We're not going to move. Now we start to scan D2 in X and Y in two dimensions. Okay, we start to. The condition is we have to get the twin. So what do you expect when you scan that? Now, there's nothing here, right? Do you expect anything there? And probably not. But it's very interesting. When we scan that, we get UMBC. Okay. It's very interesting. And of course, there's another condition has to be satisfied is this distance. We call the SO, object distance. Another distance from the lens going backward to the source, going forward to the second detector, we call the SI, has to satisfy the Gaussian thin lens equation. If your detector is not in the position, you're going to see a blurred image. Okay, actually very sensitive. Has to be correctly to put in the direction, the position in order to see that. Okay, but we did see that. I can tell you the story that in 1995, I was invited to a conference that's a high energy particle physicist, about 250 to 300 something. And I was invited by a senior professor because he visited Maryland. He learned about the experiment. He was very excited. So I gave a talk. First, just like this, I describe the experiment and ask, do you believe me? Who believe me? No one. Nobody believed me, okay? Of course, I have to explain the physics later. After my explanation, of course, everybody agreed, okay? They said, yes, you should. And as a matter of fact, and in my talk, I'm afraid to call the ghost. I called a different name. The ghost was suggested by several senior professors. They said, it's just called ghost. And they suggest me to call the ghost image. And of course, there's another interference experiment simultaneously. And they suggest me call the ghost and send to physical letter. I really was pretty afraid, scared in that time to send a ghost. But anyway, it's very. You're right. Okay. Basically, this experiment, we were asking ourselves a very important question. Now, we know that we have a click, okay, for the detector, okay? So that photon must, for example, pass a one position, for example, okay, on the object. So if the signal pass a point on the object plane, a one point, do we have a unique corresponding position on this, we call the image plane at this moment, okay? To have only one unique position. That means you have position-position correlation. If you do, you get image. If you don't, of course you don't, right? Suppose on, we have a object here, But when you scan that, you get a blurred everywhere. That means you don't have a position-to-position correspondence, right? So that's the purpose. So if we know photon one stop at a position on object, on a position on the object plane, photon two stop at a position on image plane, that's a question. Yes, of course, we get that, okay? And now here we put a source in the middle, the signal going to left, Adler going to right, and you see each of the pair, they do have a momentum conservation, the transverse momentum conservation, and now we have two point-to-point correspondence. So what we see is we have K1 plus K2 equal to zero here, this is a constant. And however, the delta K1 is infinity, delta K2 is infinity, and also we have X1 minor S2 equal to zero. However, delta X1 equal to infinity, delta X2 equal to infinity. So this experiment is for that purpose, okay? This is our original purpose. We did this experiment. Okay, we do have simultaneously those two functions, delta functions, EPR delta function. So of course, we still have questions regarding the fundamental issues of quantum theory, but really that the quantum entanglement has indeed led to no technical concepts, some of them already been introduced to, I hope, very soon to the industry. There are too many of those. I think I'm going to skip all of them except one. I want to make Professor Merman happy. The synchronization of distant clocks. In your talk, you synchronize your distant clock. You have to depend on the assumption that two-way speed of light is the same. For this synchronization, it's a one-way synchronization. You don't need to make the light going back and forth. Just a one way. You send light photon from here to there. Just one way. You can synchronize clock. And here is the structure. That's our EPR source. The photon one going to a distant clock here. Okay, actually, here's a clock. First of all, a detector. And there's an electronic equipment called the event timer. The event timer, what it does, first of all, there is a time base by clock one. And based on that, and you record the detection time, the registration time of the photons trigger your detector. So you make a lot of event detection. This is event detection history. And the same thing here, this is a clock two. You want to synchronize those two clocks. Here's a clock two, same event timer. You have the distribution. Now, after many measurements, you have a history here, you have the history there. So what do you do? You use a classical channel to bring this history back to the lab and compare those two histories. You have to align that in certain, suddenly you see all the coincidence. Other place you won't see it, okay? So that is the constant time difference between your clock and the distant clock. And later, of course, you can make a constant to synchronize your all clocks for your coordinate system. Now the experiment was done. Actually, recently, 2004, and we did manage that to get a resolution of a picosecond for optical distance with 3,000 meters. Unfortunately, it's not open. It's in the lab. We have to use optic fibers to simulate, okay, because some conditions. And okay, that's the experiment. Now, one more thing. How much time I have? I think we start 15 minutes late, right? You didn't count that. Okay, let me try. Okay, hopefully I can finish that. Because now Here we have a lot of great philosophers. I want to talk one more experiment. It's a Popper's experiment. Okay. I know that philosophers are very clever. Okay. So this is one of the cleverest people I have seen in the history. The Popper's experiment. Popper, I think, is a real realist, right? He really believed that a particle must have precise position and momentum, independent of any observation. So in this regard, he went a thought experiment in 1934, aimed to support his realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics. Of course, later, he changed his experiment, and after he learned about EPR. In 1934, he didn't use entangled state. After he learned from EPR, he changed to EPR's the entangled state. So here is his experiment. A entangled pair of particles are emitted from a point source here, the point source here, okay, with momentum conservation. That means they have to go to exactly opposite direction, momentum conservation. So a narrow slit on screen A here, okay, is placed in the path of particle one to provide the precise knowledge of its position on the y-axis. And this also determines the precise y position of its twin, particle two, on screen B, right, because EPR, right? So one goes past here, the other one must pass the same, okay? Now, he said, let's do the following measurement. Now, on screen B, if you put a real slit, so behind the slit, you put a bunch of detectors, you're looking for the diffraction patterns. You have a real slit. Do you have a diffraction pattern? Of course, we should, right? We should have a diffraction because there's a real slit. Now, question comes from here. If you take the slit away, do you still have a diffraction pattern determined by the width of delta x2, right? Delta x1 is like that. If you have a delta x2 equal to delta x1, you have a diffraction pattern, a big one, okay? Now you take it away, there's nothing there, but you know whenever you have a particle one past that, the particle two must be constrained within delta two, just like this. Do you have a diffraction pattern? That's the question he asked. It's a very clever question. A lot of people thought, yes, of course you have to, because the uncertainty in position of particle two is delta x two. Yes, your delta p two has to be big, right? In order to, he said no. Because you don't have a slit there, you're not going to have it. Although you're doing coincidence. It's not going to be there. Okay, let's see. Of course, his experiment was criticized for many, many years because people said you cannot propose a point source because point source cannot give you that kind of correlation, right? The point source cannot give you. You're violating a certain principle in the beginning. So he was criticized. But actually, as a matter of fact, the point source is not a necessary condition for Popper's experiment. It's possible you use a different source. Okay, so what we did, we know that we have a quantum imaging already, right? So we have an imaging, so we're taking advantage of quantum imaging to experiment, a Popper's experiment. Now here is our source. We have a lens. We have a slit B. Now, this is not a point source anymore. This is a big source. Actually, we try to make a source as big as possible. Now, we have immediately, we have an image here. That means we have a point-to-point correspondence between the A and the B. Because according to Gaussian Sinlens equation, if we have SO equal 2F, and we put our image plan on the 2F here, and the size of slit B here, I'm sorry, the image of B, supposed to be equal to the same size, right? Equal size image, we have that. That means whenever the signal photon passes the slit A, it has to be because it's, the other has been blocked. You get a click here, you are sure you get an image, that means the atom of photon must be confined into that same size. It's satisfied, we can do that. So we're going to measure, just according to power, to measure two different. Okay, one is with slit, another without slit. We're going to ask ourselves, do we have a diffraction pattern here? Yes, we know we're going to have a diffraction pattern here, and we can learn how big it has to be. If we measure here, it's smaller than that, and Popper was correct, right? You know? The experiment, I don't want to make a detail, but anyway. Here's the experiment result. Here is the measurement with this slit B. We get a diffraction just as everybody expects. It's very easy to calculate, very easy to do, like a classical. However, when you take that slit B away, you measure the same thing in the same position, you scan your detector, same position, you get narrow distribution. Okay? Although you know the particle two or the photon two has been constrained to delta x two in that same size like that, you're not going to have any diffraction like this. Okay, this is the measurement. If you want to know the detail, I can give you a paper. But anyway, this paper was rejected by a lot of journals. Finally, we published in Foundations of Physics. And the editor was very helpful. Said, okay, send to me. Okay, we published that. Take a lot of effort. So let me quickly to get into the conclusion. So first, we understand the physics is really very important. The two is not one plus one. We're talking about two, the particle of two appear. That physics, we have to be very careful. We know what kind of state we're talking about, what kind of measurement we're dealing with. It's very different than the state of one and the state of the measurement one. We do not mix them up together. Okay, that part is clear. The second conclusion is really the two particle superposition take responsibility for all those strange things coming from the two delta function. You get the reality, causality, whatever you get from that. It's the superposition of two particle states. That, to me, is still a mystery. So probably I would say that Feynman was correct to say that the only mystery in quantum mechanics is the superposition principle. Thank you very much. Okay, the referee said that we don't believe that Popper was correct. And a lot of them, I understand, they don't hate me, they hate Popper. That's, I don't know why, but later I met one of them, and he was very, very honest, told me that he was the referee. He said, I like you, okay? I like your experiment, but really I don't like Popper. So that's the reason in your paper you didn't see Popper was wrong. You said Popper's prediction was correct. But I did see in my paper, in our paper, Popper's prediction was correct, but probably his philosophy was wrong. But anyway, that's a very interesting story. Yeah. I guess so, yes. In his first paper, 1935, he doesn't. Yeah. later he changed his mind. Yeah, later he changed. Yeah, that's it. Ah. Yeah. In the first paper. Oh, I see. Oh, I see. Okay, that's a completely different story I learned. Oh, okay. Very good comment. If you just want to make image, you don't. As a matter of fact, I told you, we can use thermal light to make the image. But you never get position-position correlation. Because the visibility, as you know, only 50%, no, 33%, okay? This experiment is purely for the fundamental purpose. We didn't try to see this for the imaging or something, which this is for the fundamental purpose we did for the position-position correlation. For the EPR, we do need that. Yes, for the EPR. Yes. And if you really just want to get the image, you don't care about the visibility, how poor it is, thermal light can do it. Actually, we are doing that now. Okay, that's a very good question. Okay, what she said is she asked that your EPR state is generated with the correlation, right? After propagation, when they reach the detector, do you still have the correlation between those pairs? Okay, that's a very good question. Can you consider they're independent? It's this. Yes, we probably know. Or we don't know. We assume we have that state from the generated from the source. As an experimentalist, when you do the measurement, you cannot assume you have a certain state. You assume that you have something coming from the source. You want to approve it is the state. So when you try to do the experiment, you have to think about something that usually I learned from GHZ. They told me that the source is what do you call that, comes nowhere or something like that. You just cannot see, you know anything. You want to do the Bayesian equivalent, this kind of measurement, right, to do that. So in this sense, if there's no communication between those two particles, there is no action at a distance. They are separated, and you want to do a space-like separating event for those two, you have to consider they're independent, right? They're interaction free. They are in distance. They're not in the source anymore. So that's the starting point. And if you do that kind of measurement, and this measurement has to follow the classical statistics. But the interesting thing is, as you said, or when you look at the experiment result, it's very surprised, yes, you do have the EPR delta function. Then you would ask, how do you get this from your independent measurement? Then we look, go again. We go, oh, yes, we follow global theory. We get all the amplitude. We summarize, add them together. We get it. But when you do the summation, you do the superposition, then you ask yourself, what am I doing? This superposition is not local. How can I do this? It's not the classical addition of the field. This is addition of the two photon amplitude through the, after the measurement. So what I'm doing? Yes, you are proved, you get the state, everything is correct, but there's a big puzzle, as I said later. That superposition is non-local. If you believe you can do that, it's okay. Basically, quantum mechanics said, yes, you have to do it, it's correct. But do you believe or not? That's really up to us. Oh, I see. Does that mean? Probably. Partially, you're saying it. I think you're, that's a good question, too. Okay. How do you, sure, when you, yeah. That's correct. Yeah. Like Niklas tried in how many kilometers he tried, but it's still there, right? So we know it's there. And why? How? We have to ask ourselves, right? Okay. Thank you so much.